I am Father C. John McCloskey, the director of the Catholic Information Center of the Archdiocese of Washington and a priest of the Prelature Opus Dei. Welcome to another episode of our EWTN series dedicated to exploring the life, work, and thought of the Venerable Cardinal John Henry Newman. Today's guest is Father Ian Carr, the priest of the Diocese of Portsmouth, England, a renowned Newman scholar who has many books to his credit on the Cardinal Newman, and many of them are still in print. He is, in addition to being a parish priest, he is also a tutor at Campion Hall at the University of Oxford in England. Father Carr has also been a visiting professor, indeed a chaired professor, in the United States at various Catholic colleges. I want to welcome Father Carr back again to our continuing series on the Venerable John Henry Newman. On an earlier episode, we had an overview of his life, and today we're going to take a particular aspect, we could say, of his theological thought, one which I think will be of particular interest to viewers of EWTN, because without question the great number of them are laity, although certainly there are priests and religious also. So I thought we would, the topic, of course, is the laity, and I thought I'd start off by asking you to go a little bit into the, perhaps, what would be the view of the laity in Catholic England in the latter part of the 19th century, and then we can explore how Newman's concept differed from that and developed that.
Yes, well, it was really in Ireland that Newman came across this phenomenon, which was strange to him as an ex-Anglican, because he hadn't experienced this as a member of the Church of England, but this phenomenon of extreme clericalism, whereby the laity was sort of kept down. And it particularly affected him when he went to Dublin to found the Catholic University of Ireland, because he couldn't even set up a finance committee with lay people on it. And as you Americans know only too well, to raise money you have to win people's support and get them involved. And the bishops wouldn't even allow him to have lay people, the very people who were going to, of course, to have to contribute the money. So this profoundly shocked him. And he also got into trouble with the bishops for appointing young Irish nationalists to teaching appointments in the university. Again, lay people, and the bishops were very suspicious of that. And then when he came back to England, he was confronted with this huge controversy over a magazine called The Rambler, which was, I suppose we'd call it, a liberal Catholic, but not nearly as liberal as we would understand probably by that now. They were certainly weren't liberal Catholic in the way some people are today. But it was considered then a liberal Catholic magazine. And there was a controversy going on about the question of Catholic schools in England. Because the Catholic bishops, there was a so-called, what we call a royal commission in England, that's to say, a parliamentary study of the question of schools. And our Catholic schools were getting aid then, as they still are, heavily aided by the state. And the government wanted to have inspectors to go into these schools, and the Catholic bishops were resisting this very strongly, because they thought this was interference. And the Rambler thought very strongly that the Catholic laity should be consulted on this matter. I mean, because after all, they were the people who were sending their children to the schools, and they were concerned, obviously, about the question of if the church refused to cooperate with the state, then the state might cut off all its funding. So this is a problem where, insofar as it was a problem, it ought to involve the whole of the church and not just be a concern for the bishops. So this also shocked Newman, and he realized that this was a big problem in the church in the 19th century.
Now, without entering too deeply into the controversy, because we're trying to develop the more positive aspects of Newman's thought on the laity, in writing this article on consulting the faithful, a little bit of a firestorm arose as a result of his views, which I believe is fair to say were pretty much misunderstood by authorities both in England and in Rome.
Yes, it was a very Newmanian episode, really. as I say, the Rambler was in trouble with the hierarchy. In those days, bishops had much more power, I suppose, than they do today in closing. And so there was a real threat the magazine would simply be closed down. And so Newman was asked to become editor as a temporary editor to sort of tide things over, because he was acceptable to the bishops, but he was also acceptable to the editors of the people who were running the Catholic Rambler, and people like Lord Acton. And so he took it on very reluctantly. And with that sort of, I suppose some people would think, lack of worldliness so characterized Newman, he decided to, in view of this controversy about the laity, he decided to write an article, which was a theological article, really, on the question of what he called the faithful, on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine. And he went back to the 4th century, where, after all, about which his first book had been written. He had established himself in Oxford as a foremost world authority on patristics, particularly the Greek fathers, and his area of specialization was the Arian heresy in the 4th century. So he knew a lot about it, and he went back to the 4th century in order to write this article on consulting the faithful. And this was the article, of course, that got him into so much trouble, published in 1859. And he did give an explanation of some things that were objected to in the article, but unfortunately, because Wiseman was ill, Cardinal Wiseman of Westminster was ill, these answers never reached Rome. And so Newman was considered, it was considered in the Roman Curia that he had refused in a kind of disobedient way to give an answer to the points that had been raised.
Okay.
The primary question was this word consulting, and here this is rather characteristic of Newman, to perhaps you might say, to not to be a bit more cunning about this, and that he would be so easily misunderstood, because in the article what he's talking about in the theological sense, really, he's talking about consulting in the way in which one consults one's watch. Consulting the faithful, what is the faith of the baptized?
The state of the faithful,
exactly.
Or an awareness of their condition.
Yes. But given the fact that, of course, he was also concerned, lying behind this article, was this concern about consulting the faithful or the laity in a different way, in other words, asking their opinion, what did they think should be done about these Catholic schools? Mm-hmm. So this was the equivocation, the ambiguity, and you may say Newman was rather naive not to have foreseen the storm that would break.
Mm-hmm.
Because it looked as if Newman was saying that the laity, because the faithful was understood to mean the laity, that the laity should be consulted about what to believe. I mean, you know, that you simply say to the laity, do you believe in this doctrine or not? You know, and you vote.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what Newman meant at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a document that came out quite recently from the Holy See, actually it's the Apostolic Exhortation written after the Synod on the Americas, a synod that was covered here on EWTN, the Holy Father speaks about, for the new evangelization of America, which is now North, South, and Central, he's quite clear in speaking, he uses the phrase, a theology of the laity.
Mm.
In the mid-19th century, was there a theology of the laity, and what was Cardinal Newman's role at that moment in terms of introducing that concept or the importance of the laity in the church?
Well, there was a very famous remark made in England, what is the province of the laity? To hunt, shoot, and to fish, by one of the leading ultramontanes. In other words, the laity were there to, as I don't know if this is an expression in America, to pay and to pray. That was the was the view of the laity. But, of course, on the theological front, it had not been lost sight of, that the baptized faithful were quite an important part of the church. And indeed, as Newman points out in his article that got him into so much trouble, when Pius IX defined the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, he wanted to know from the bishops of the world what was the faith of the people.
The sensum fidelium.
The sensus fidelium.
Mm-hmm.
So Newman was able to appeal to that, and he appealed to the Roman, leading Roman theologian Giovanni Peroni, making the same point that the sources, how do we discover what is the faith? Well, there is, of course, the scriptures, the liturgy, the fathers, the tradition, but the sensus fidelium is also one of the things we look at when we're looking to see what is the faith of the church.
As we speak about Newman's thought on the laity and continue to develop that, maybe we just step back a little bit back to a prior program in which you participated. Could it be not that the Newman had a deeper appreciation of the laity precisely because of his great secular interests? That is, he was a man who played the violin, who had an appreciation for wine, who was new university life, who came from a certain background, I believe you referred to as kind of upper middle class. My father was a banker. He had a wide variety of friends in all the professions, barristers.
That's true, of course, yes. He hadn't led a clerical life, in a very narrowly ecclesiastical life.
Mm-hmm.
I think one also has to remember, and this is perhaps something we could explore a bit deeper, we have to remember, which we've already talked about in the first program we did, the Oxford movement itself. Now, the word movement, of course, is a word that's very current in the Catholic Church today. and perhaps we may be able to talk a bit about this. But the Oxford movement, or the Tractarian movement, as it was also called, of course, consisted of laity as well. They were very important in it. A leading politician like William Gladstone was involved. There were lady novelists, women novelists, Charlotte M. Young. Newman considered her that kind of the literature, because women, of course, in Victorian England were particularly known for writing fiction. Newman thought that was a very important part of the Oxford movement. Mm-hmm. So it was this collaborative effort between, if you like, the clergy and the laity, which was the Oxford movement was by no means a purely clerical enterprise.
By any means. Perhaps we can go a little bit deeper into this whole theology of the laity, particularly in terms of its influence, which we'll talk about somewhat in another program on the Second Vatican Council. But it's quite clear that Newman did not simply look upon the laity as non-clerics, as indeed in the Code of Canon Law, the prior Code of Canon Law, they were looked upon or defined in that way, those people who are not clerics. Mm. Did he have a deep sense of this basic concept of the Second Vatican Council of the baptismal call to holiness? I mean, how did he think that lay people could actually become saints? It was possible for lay people to achieve holiness?
Well, I think that on consulting the faithful in matters of doctrine, if you look at it carefully, you will see that it is not really about just the laity at all. Now, it's usually thought of like that, and in fact, sometimes people call it that by mistake. They call it On Consulting the Laity, so it's not the title at all. But if you look at the examples that Newman gives from the 4th century at this time of the Arian heresy, his point being that that part of the Church which is most responsible for upholding and teaching the faith, namely the episcopate, to a large extent failed to do so. But of course the faith was not lost, because the faith doesn't belong to the hierarchy alone. It belongs to all the baptized faithful. But if you look at the examples that Newman gives from those times of the faithful who upheld the Orthodox faith against Arius, you will know one sees in the examples, for instance, holy virgins and monks are prominent. Well, we would call them religious today, wouldn't we? They didn't have that word then. And indeed, priests or presbyters, as they would have been called, were also involved. And what is particularly striking is that when Newman reproduced the substance of this article years later, when the cloud had lifted from him and he was being rehabilitated in Rome, in an appendix to that very first book that he'd published, the book on the Arian heresy, reproducing the substance of this article, he begins this appendix which he adds to the book by saying that by the laity he includes their parish priests, so to speak. He says so to speak because the parochial system wasn't in place then.
Perhaps today we would say they all form part of the faithful.
The faithful, the baptized, you see. And that's remarkable to say, talking about the laity, I also include the clergy. So I think there's an equivocation in Newman, inevitably, and I think there's also an equivocation in the Lumen Gentium, the constitution of the Church in the Second Vatican Council. Mm. Because I think Newman is speaking within terms of a very clerical church, and therefore he uses the word laity in opposition to the clergy. But he also has a profound sense, just like Lumen Gentium does in its first two chapters, of the Church of the New Testament and of the Fathers, where, of course, the whole idea of this clergy-laity thing was not prevalent, because the idea of the clerical church hadn't yet emerged. And so if you look at, say, On Consulting the Faithful, you will see that what Newman is really talking about are the baptized faithful, who may be religious, who may be priests, who may be lay in the sense of not being ordained. And if you look at those first two chapters in Lumen Gentium, you've got exactly the same vision. But then Lumen Gentium, we know, goes on, I think it's chapter 4, isn't it, to speak about the laity. But what's very interesting in that chapter, it seems to me, is that when you look down at the bottom of the page, the footnotes, instead of having a lot of scriptural and patristic authorities, the authorities quoted are in fact mostly modern papal encyclicals and documents, upholding the rights of the laity, of course, in a church which has become very clericalized.
Perhaps this is slightly getting off the point, but couldn't one say that primitive Christianity, the first centuries of Christianity, before the Edict of Milan, before the toleration, before the church was tolerated and then approved by the Roman Empire, there was basically the lay faithful and priests, deacons, and bishops. And that at some point along the line, perhaps in the going out to Egypt of the first monks, the Thebaid, that the idea began to creep in that somehow the laity, although certainly could be saved, were second-class citizens, and if you wanted to pursue holiness, You became a monk.
Well, I may be wrong about this. I assume it's Constantine, isn't it, really? It's the establishment of the church.
That's
in
right.
The Roman Empire. The
early 4th century.
And bishops become very often sort of like civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they become very important members of the state, really, and of course the clergy too. And so you get the beginnings of this institutionalized, clericalized church. But I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it, that if you say to a modern Catholic, do you realize that those two great figures of Western Christianity, Benedict and Francis, weren't priests?
Mm-hmm.
I think that would astonish most people today, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
It would totally astonish them, because they would assume that if you're a Benedictine or if you're a Franciscan, you become a priest, unless for some reason, for lack of education or something, you are unable to get ordained.
Mm-hmm.
But even that period, they're still thinking very much more like the early church.
Now, Newman chose the Oratorians, and as you well know, as a person very familiar with the oratory, St. Philip Neri was a man very much immersed in the world, the tumultuous world of Rome of the 16th century, and also had a great attraction for all types of people from all walks of life, particularly intellectuals, nobility, young people also.
Mm.
And could it be that Newman chose the oratory in part because he felt more comfortable in that secular atmosphere as opposed to religious life in his own particular case?
Yes, I think that's true. And also one has to remember that, and this all struck Newman very forcibly, and you can see this if you look at his oratory papers which survive, that he saw quite clearly that Philip Neri was trying to get back to something much more primitive. Because after all, the oratory didn't start as a religious order. It wasn't as if Philip decided he's going to set up a new order of priests. It began simply as a community of people coming together, rather like some of the new modern movements or communities, simply baptized people coming together to pray, to discuss their faith, to share their faith, and so on. And then out of those members, some of them were ordained.
Mm-hmm. Now, we could speak just for a moment to the particular theme of Newman's influence in the Second Vatican Council, not on other areas, which we'll address happily with you in another program, but on this whole, the idea of the laity, because it's truly, when we say a return or a development of the idea of the laity that takes place, that you see in Lumen Gentium, the dogmatic constitution of the Church, and also in the pastoral constitution of the Church in the modern world, Gaudium et Spes. Where would you see Newman's influence in those documents in the Second Vatican Council in terms of the laity?
Well, it's very, I mean, I think in the Constitution on Revelation, or the Decree on Revelation, one can find a phrase there about development, which I think is almost certainly, there's a clear Newmanian influence. I think it's not always clear one can speak about direct influence of Newman on the council. Mm. The fact is that the people who were making that council, theologians, well, knew about Newman. He was the towering figure behind. Why was he so important? Because he anticipated in Oxford, in England, in the century before, the great ressourcement in France, particularly in France, going back to the sources in the scriptures and the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And that magnificent vision in the first two chapters of Lumen Gentium is, I think, the real revolutionary, but not really revolutionary, but going back to the sources, that is, I think, the most important part of the Second Vatican Council. Going back to a vision of the Church consisting of the baptized faithful. And as the Pope John Paul himself has said, the most important thing about me is not that I'm Pope, but that I'm a baptized Christian. And seeing the hierarchical and charismatic gifts that the Spirit bestows on the Church, seeing them in the same context. So you don't talk about clergy and laity, you speak about the baptized who receive the sacraments of initiation, who then go on, normally speaking, at least once in their life to receive the sacraments of anointing and of penance. Mm. And then some of them, well, most of them, receive the sacrament of marriage, and others receive the sacrament of holy orders. That's how Lumen Gentium sees the so-called clergy and laity.
Cardinal Newman liked the concept, would he not, of kind of an inverted pyramid, that is, not with the hierarchy and clergy at the top, but rather at the bottom in the sense of serving.
So, yes, I think much more in terms of a circle. Mm-hmm. See, because one of the reasons why I go on about stress the baptized faithful and in a way want to get away from the idea of the laity and say that Newman also had a vision of the Church where there wasn't this same idea is because I think there's a very great danger today in today's Church that we're replacing a clerical Church with a kind of lay Church. And I'm thinking of that movement that began in Austria, the We Are Church movement.
Mm-hmm.
You see, which is really saying the laity are the Church.
Mm-hmm.
So the Pope isn't a part of the Church. The bishops aren't a part, apparently, nor the clergy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a real danger of a kind of lay Church taking over. So you turn the pyramid upside down, but instead of the orders coming from the top, from the Pope downwards, they come from the bottom up, so that the hierarchy and the clergy become like the administration and the politician, you know, and the electorate, the laity, tell them what to do. They decide what the policies are going to be.
Take polls.
Well, in the first place, it is the faithful, the baptized faithful, and it means the faithful. It means those who are faithful to their baptismal promises. It doesn't mean just any old Tom, Dick and Harry who happens to have been baptized. So I think that is the big danger today, and why I resist when people talk about Newman and the laity. I was worried about this, because I am concerned, I think Newman would be very concerned, at this idea of the politicization of the church, whereby you replace the clergy with the laity.
It's quite impressive, is it not, in your reading of Cardinal Newman and your deep research, and to see the reverence that he has for dogma and doctrine, for the incredible reverence he indeed had for his ordinary, for bishops, and how obedient he was, even in matters that he would find very difficult humanly to put up with. And so there was a real sense of submission to truth, and I think he would want that also for the lay faithful.
Yes, I mean, the Lumen Gentium is quite clear that these gifts, hierarchic and charismatic, come from the Spirit. But the charismatic gifts have to be, at the end of the day, subject to the hierarchic gifts. They have to be subject to authority. As St. Paul says, apostles first. But then St. Paul doesn't say apostles first, bishops first, and then clergy and then laity. St. Paul says apostles first, and then evangelists, teachers, healers, and so on. And that's the kind of church that Lumen Gentium in its first two chapters puts before us. And I think Newman understood that church because of his deep studies in the early centuries.
A recent Catholic writer said that the Second Vatican Council was not as much about the role of the lay person in the church as it was about the role of the lay Catholic in the world. So I wonder if you could comment on that in terms of the idea of Cardinal Newman, that is this concept which we really haven't talked about yet, and we do not have much time to do so today, but of evangelization, of apostolate, of bearing witness, or in a phrase that I'm very fond of, that you know better than I, the personal influence that we as Christians are called to exert on the people around us to win them and bring them closer to Christ. Could you comment on that in Cardinal Newman?
Well, I think there's been a can I approach answering the question by saying this? Has there not been a shift in the church? In the sense, first of all, in the 19th century, you get this very clerical church where there's really no sense of the laity. Then you get a shift to the idea of the laity living out their vocation in the world, but the clergy are still the people, perhaps with the religious, who are responsible for evangelization. So you have the worker priest movement in France.
Or the Catholic Action concept.
Catholic Action, yes. But I think now we're seeing, with the rise of the new ecclesial movements in the church, which I think are the fleshing out of those first two chapters of Lumen Gentium and are implementing the council in actual through the Spirit in terms of flesh and blood, what we're seeing there is so-called lay people, the baptized, who aren't necessarily priests, but also involved in evangelization, involved with the gifts of prophecy and so on that Paul speaks of. So I think there has been a shift, and I go back now to answer your question about Newman. I think that was true of the Oxford movement, because Newman would not have thought of a Tractarian Anglican as somebody merely who tried to live out their sense in the world of being a member of the church as Christ's body, as the Tractarians understood it, because Newman saw these lay people as also being part of the movement in terms of propagating it.
So they were, in one sense, assisting the clergy, but in another sense,
yes,
on their own,
exactly,
belief as Christians that this was something necessary—a reform, a renewal inside of Anglicanism, a return to more primitive Christianity.
Yes.
That they had their role, and that came not simply because they were told to do so, because they discerned that it was something that God wanted them to do.
Yes. I mean, I think that I know you're a priest of Opus Dei. It seems to me that that inspiration of Escriva was something that anticipated the new movements we have today. Because, as you know much better than I do, there are people in Opus Dei that it isn't, that Opus Dei priests, I understand, are much more like chaplains to, rather than the usual kind of understanding we have, because your numeraries and people are very important in Opus Dei, aren't they?
They are indeed.
They're important in their own right, you know.
Absolutely.
Whereas I think there is still this clerical church which still thinks in terms of collaborative ministry, whereby the laity are just there to collaborate with the priest, to help them carry out their ecclesial functions because there aren't enough priests.
Newman was a great spiritual director who had a direct influence, even personally, to dozens or perhaps hundreds, who knows if a thousand people. One only has to look at his correspondence or people who write about the influence. Did he always help people towards that ideal of holiness and spiritual direction, and that as lay people it was possible to lead a life of devotion?
Oh yes, I don't think, see, Newman really didn't have this idea that the lay people, as you know, as we've already talked about this. He carried on, of course, a huge correspondence, apart from personal contact, with an enormous number of people in helping them, very often, to become Catholics. No, he didn't have any sense that this was... St. Francis de Sales was a great influence on him, and indeed it was his picture that he has in his chapel in Birmingham, in the Birmingham Oratory, rather than that of Philip Neri, interestingly enough. Many people think it's Philip, but it isn't, it's Francis. That's partly because he stood for Christian humanism, which was something very close to Newman's heart, but it was also this idea of the devout life, that it was possible for people who weren't priests or religious to lead devout Christian lives.
And of course St. Francis de Sales is one of the great apostles of the laity.
Exactly.
way before.
Exactly.
I believe that his motto, the motto of Cardinal Newman, was cor ad cor loquitur, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that was taken from some of the writings of St. Francis de Sales.
Yes, it's interesting. When he was called to receive the Red Hat in Rome, he couldn't remember where the phrase came from. He'd actually quoted it in a slightly different form in his great classic, The Idea of University. Mm-hmm. It comes from one of St. Francis de Sales' letters.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, I want to thank you again, Father Carr, for being with us. We look forward to future appearances on this series. Today we've been speaking heart to heart and speaking about one of our favorite subjects, John Henry Newman. Our viewers know that Father Carr is perhaps the foremost English-speaking expert on Cardinal Newman, and it's a real pleasure for us to have him come all the way over from England across the pond to be with us today. We look forward to our viewers being with us for our next episode of John Henry Newman in the year 2000.